I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The new narrative form and style of American politics have 9 weeks to run, the most marked shift since the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960. Now, as then, TV is the fulcrum of change, but it's not about Kennedy's cool or Nixon's sweaty upper lip this time. It's about rough-and-tumble screen language and body language of boasting, outrage, insult, you're unfit and you're corrupt from both sides. It's a race to some dark bottom seen on reality TV, as it's called, and TV drama high and low that commands as much audience attention as, say, the Obama White House. So here is how the campaign sounds at the start of the last long lap.
I'd love to use a teleprompter. I'd have one here, and I'd go like this. Ba-ba, 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 and everybody's going to fall asleep. If you're running for president, you shouldn't be allowed to use a teleprompter.
I think we have to keep reminding him this is not a reality TV show. You can't say to the head of another nation's government, you're fired. That is not the way it works in the real world, does it?
What does work in the real world? This hour, we're doping out the rules in the making of a president 2016 and trying to conjure who wrote those rules and this script. Ron Suskind has the keynote, ace reporter outside any of the old boxes. Frank Rich, New York Times theater critic turned TV series producer, joins us. And then Emily Nussbaum, the New Yorker magazine TV critic. Ron Suskind, welcome to Open Source.
Good to be here.
You broke the code of the George Bush White House when you discovered that their operating rule, as your mystery source put it, we thought it was Karl Rove, was that the reality-based community in conventional politics and commentary, that's us, was completely clueless. Right. The Bush people were in the business, they thought, of making reality, inventing stuff on the ground. They were faith-based or fantasy-based. And still fascinating. The tricky word we still fix on is reality, as in reality TV. Is it the same word?
No, sure, sure. But, you know, the thing is, reality is taking new shapes now. And that's why we have to look at that old phrase, reality-based community, that was defining back when the Bush folks were innovating, saying, look, we're loosed from the barriers and bonds of reality. We're playing a kind of metagame. Our words don't necessarily mean what we say. They're code. You know, look at our faces, look at our brows. Our people know what we're talking about. And the reality-based community, when I wrote that in the New York Times, mostly on the left, to be sure, said, aha, see, we're right. They are divorced from reality, and that's where disaster breeds. Meanwhile, the folks on the other side said, no, you're playing checkers. We're playing chess. We're playing a metagame, tapping deep nativist urges in people, senses of their own identity and dislocation. And ultimately, Bush flouted reality and paid very little price for it. Remember that 2004 election? Everyone knew it was a disaster by then, but they were experimenting with this sort of unbound sort of a liberalization of strategy.
Fascinating. He's still not paying a big price compared to, say, Tony Blair. That's another whole conversation.
Yes, indeed.
The mission tonight is to explain what the American narrative of 2016 is all about, and then to explain why this race is so close.
Okay, so here's what's interesting. So if you really look along the long span of the last 20 or 30 years, what you find is certainly the Bush crowd and some of their antecedents as well. You can take some of this back to Reagan. What was happening is that many folks in the wide middle of the country, you know, as divorced in some ways from the folks on the coast as the North and the South before the Civil War, very different cultures. What was happening is they were being distracted by social wedge issues, us-them issues, abortion, gay rights, tribal issues, to say those other folks are not like you and you're going to have your say, shiny objects. So they were looking at that while they were voting against their economic interests. That's why back then people were wondering about reality and people not discovering it in the mid-aughts. Now, what happened here is that Trump got this. And frankly, the wide middle of the country got it, too.
How? When? Where did he get it?
Well, he got it early here. That's why he wiped out all those stages of Republicans. They were using old playbooks. And Trump was saying, you know something? You're getting screwed. You in middle America.
You people, you voters.
And that's reality, actually. You see, Trump is mindful of underlying reality, even in ways many of those Republican opponents were not. So he said, basically, don't worry about the shiny objects of abortion or gay rights or these wedge issues. Worry about the fact you're getting screwed. You're in a race to the bottom with people who will be happy with $3 a day, okay? You're over. On the coastlines are in the updraft of the global economy. They're fine. You're left behind. I'm going to be the guy who bloodies everybody on the coast, the cognoscenti, the establishment, on your behalf, even though I lived among them and I've got golden towers on both coasts. That's a moment that no one got, and they still don't get it. They don't get the fact that they in our land, Chris, okay, let's be frank about it. Here in the Northeast Corridor, in California, on the coast, they don't understand that the folks in the middle are not idiots. They're not, even though sometimes we make them out to be. They don't know what they're doing. They're voting against their economic interests. They don't even realize it's happening. That's not actually the way it works. They're just like we are. They vote based on their self-interest. And Trump is playing to it. And that's why when he's attacked from all our friends in the cognoscenti, he's foolish, he's lying, he doesn't know what's what, he doesn't know history. All of that makes no difference. Because when we say it, we're inaudible to those folks in the wide middle who feel disenfranchised. They can't even hear our voices. I visited there. I walked there with a pad. And the fact is still, here in the establishment, they still don't get it. I can't believe Trump's only 3 points behind.
Well, that's absolutely right. I just want to say I never thought they were stupid. And I also listened to Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan more than a year ago, who said, watch out, total name recognition. He's talking jobs. He has his own money. This is going to be serious. Nobody picked up on that really until a few months ago.
They were absolutely right. They're absolutely right because both of those guys understood the way reality will assert itself eventually, and it's asserting itself now. Trump is speaking to it in a way that often is not recognized.
Is that why he's closing the gap here?
I think it is. You know, I mean,
what do you make of the gap? What does he do next?
Well, you know,
what does he do in debates?
Well, you know, the fact is that he understands the fact that as soon as he starts getting telepromptered, he loses his juice. And let me tell you what he
loses. Isn't that funny? You can't use teleprompters in a political campaign. That's smart. And I've got a wonderful reaction, even in my, you know, goosebumps.
And who
right on.
Exactly, Chris. Who doesn't cheer by that? You know, you're seeing them essentially automatons reading the same script over and over again. Trump gets something. He understands that the reality-based community is now being replaced by reality show values. Okay? And he knows how those work. And here's some of the principles.
Let's hear them.
Reality show values. Make sure it happens on the screen if you can.
Meaning?
Try to evolve or devolve. Just keep moving. Make sure their eyes are always on you. That's important. Make sure even if what you say is nonsensical and you flip back later and you say I lied or I was wrong, they can't take their eyes off you. Here's the thing. Let me tell you an amazing little piece of advice I got when I was doing TV. I was working for Ted Koppel. I used to go on that show once in a while on ABC. And there was a brilliant producer there named Dan Green. He didn't have to the Gates people. And he said to me at one night, we were up, I think, drinking. He says, why do you watch sports on television? I said, well, I love sports. He said, no. It's the only thing that happens on television. It actually occurs. That's why you can't stop watching it. Trump occurs. That's why we can't take our eyes off him. And he understands that that's power. He flip-flops 4 times in a day. Did he say it? Did he not say it? Is he taking it back? There's 4 different news stories between the morning and the night. Hillary Clinton, what did she do that day? Was she even working? He's got another day when you're thinking only about what Trump thinks or feels or what he's going to say next. And because he occurs, he actually happens in front of your eyes. You can't stop watching. That's power.
It's true. There's a bit of Emerson there, too. Every man, whoso would be a man, must be a nonconformist, and don't worry about consistency. Say anything.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Say it before anybody else says it.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. You know, and so instead, what he's doing is upsetting a kind of political reality that's thin and hollow and brittle. Look, if you had to basically run the tables and never say anything wrong as a politician, you're going to get smaller and smaller and more brittle and more narrow all the time. We make mistakes. Mm. We do things that were incorrect. We say we're sorry. That's what we do in real life. Politicians more and more have been narrowed down where they've not been able to do that. Trump gets that, which is why he's all over the place. He says what he feels. Some of it is horrific. It's racist. It's pure bigotry. It's misogynistic. And it vanishes. I mean, 48 hours. No scandal lasts more than 48 hours. What happened to the cons and the gold star mother? People don't even talk about it anymore. We've moved on. What now? What next?
Back to the rules. These are Roger Ailes' rules, too, not from Fox lately, but from the selling of the president, Richard Nixon, in 1968. It was the man in the arena, action, let it happen there with Bud Wilkinson and all that stuff.
Absolutely right. They used sports metaphors, and they understood it was like sports. That was an insight they had. Make sure something happens that seems to be happening in present tense. You know, now, of course, Trump's taken to a whole new level. I mean, what's interesting, if you turn the sound off on the TV and watch him, mm-hmm. you see a real professional at work. You'll see that he goes through about 9 different expressions in 18 seconds. And then he repeats them like a Hanna-Barbera, you know, scene going by in the mm-hmm. cartoon. That's something you learn as a professional if you live on a camera, in front of a camera for years. It's a trick, but it's very appealing. If you've ever had a camera on you to do a reality show, it's hard. You run out of stuff. It's hard to keep it going. But he knows how to do that. And that's why they can't take their eyes off him. And they're making a decision. People are deep down. And it's something they don't even think about or even feel they're making. Do I want to spend 4 years with Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton up ahead? And even if they think it's right to be with Hillary, they think about, hey, it might be more fun to be with Trump.
We're going to have to talk about his opponent and what she hasn't learned in all the years about this kind of performance. Ron Suskind is our guest. Coming up, the universal drama buff, Frank Rich, who covered Hollywood for Time magazine and then Broadway for the New York Times, and now produces the hilarious spoof series Veep for HBO. This is Open Source. For the third time in a political season that almost nobody knows how to cover, we asked theater man Frank Rich to review it as showbiz on the small screen.
Well, we have to separate a couple of different strands here. First of all, one reason why the news media, including a lot of the television news media, has been blindsided is the separation between news television and entertainment television. Even though news television has increasingly resembled entertainment dating back to when Paddy Chayefsky was making fun of it in Network 4 decades ago, it's still a different breed from the world of reality shows like, say, Celebrity Apprentice or Worldwide Wrestling or anything you want to choose. And so what's snuck up on people here, it's the entertainment television vocabulary that is dominating. And this is about reality television. It's about the Kardashians. It's about Donald Trump. The problem for Hillary Clinton, not unlike some of the political press, is it's a world she doesn't know at all, and that Donald Trump is completely fluent in. And so when Hillary Clinton gives out on camera reasonable proposals or plans, as she calls them, and, you know, PowerPoints about a foreign policy or whatever it is, it doesn't play in this arena. And in that sense, we're seeing a variation on what hit Nixon in 1960, in that Nixon did not understand that he was outmatched by Kennedy in television debates, even though people listening on radio often thought he won on the merits because of image. This is now several generations after that, but it's worth noting Nixon made his comeback 8 years after 1960, in large part by turning to a young media consultant named Roger Ailes. And what's been successful about Fox News, regardless of its political profile, has been that Ailes understands entertainment television the way that news division heads generally don't, either in network or cable news. So he has a showmanship that's very rare. Don Hewitt had this when he created 60 Minutes, but basically it's very rare in television news. One other point, I think this is the end of this. By the time we get to the next presidential election in 4 years, television of this sort is going to have faded. Let's not forget that Trump is around 70 years old, that the kind of entertainment TV he's coming out of is also probably going to be nearing the end of its shelf life in 4 years, as it's supplanted entirely by what people watch on their phones, including, for instance, the whole new YouTube culture that's springing up very, very rapidly and catching network television by surprise. So I think this is the culmination of something that's been going on for more than half a century, but I also think it's the last great final gasp of it.
I'm so glad you mentioned 1960. What we remember about Kennedy Nixon was, as you say, the McLuhan campaign, the hot and cool, the TV impressions. Most of all, I remember Norman Mailer's piece, Superman in the Supermarket, which identified something absolutely indescribable. He called Kennedy the most conquistadorial of the Democratic candidates who captured the party. But also, he touched on Kennedy as the candidate, for all his record, his good, sound, conventional liberal record, it had a patina of that other life, the second American life, the long electric night with the fires of neon leading down the highway to the murmur of jazz. Some indescribable force, but certainly the force has landed on the Donald this time.
Right. Mailer, both in that early piece for Esquire and also in the two classic pieces, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, that he wrote for Harper's during the 68 campaign. Mm. If you read those again, too, you'll see a refinement of that thinking, which really is about show business. And keep in mind, Mailer, although a novelist and a new journalist, I guess we'd also say, or the author of nonfiction novels, was very attuned to show business. He made movies. He understood movies and television. So he was very sensitive in a way that, you know, James Reston would not have been, you know, or Walter Lippmann, to what this all meant. And so Trump is the ultimate vulgarization of a Kennedy, Jack Kennedy. Mm-hmm. He was charming. He was witty. He was handsome. He was fast on his feet. He had a sense of humor, which certainly Nixon did not have. Now, those qualities have degenerated into kind of a character who is basically a world-class sort of huckster, showman, P.T. Barnum-type figure, but someone who really understands how to use television, if only through practice. My guess is that, except for cable news and his own show, Trump doesn't even watch a lot of television. I'd be shocked if he's ever watched The West Wing or American Horror Story or anything. I'd be shocked if he watched serious television. But that doesn't matter. What he learned, he actually learned in making television. And you learn a lot.
That was Frank Rich, executive producer of the HBO comedy hit Veep, which is about the profane and plastic Vice President Selina Meyer. Ron Suskind is our guest in the studio. Omni-journalist and author. He teaches public narrative and justice at the Harvard Law School. Fascinating. Frank Rich is just saying, you learn something doing television. What has he learned?
You learn to be real in unreal situations. Television is very unreal. If you've been on camera, it's hard. You're in some foreign place. You've got the eye of a camera on you, and you must summon a show of reality. That's why it's called reality show. It is distilled down into a form.
There's a wonderful brief bit on Humans of New York online in which Hillary Clinton is describing how hard that is. And she studied her husband, she studied the man she works for, and she says they work at it too.
Yeah, well, they do. But they're also Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton is a natural at that. You know that, Chris. I know it is. I know it as well. And, you know, the thing is it Clinton just, he breathes that right back to the camera. I mean, you know, you turn that camera on and he is white hot and so natural. In some ways, he's more natural with the camera on than with it off. Some people are like that. Trump is like that. You know, you see him without
the camera. John Lindsay was like
John Lindsay. There's some people who literally, they transmogrify themselves when that camera light comes on. Peter Jennings was that way. Trump is that way. That's why he's in the profession he's in. Hey, mind you, he actually built a business that was a reality show before we even had the term. He's been at this for a very long time, and she's up against a master in creating reality for show on cue. She's up against a very difficult opponent here, and I'm not sure what she will do or what she knows to do.
Let me just say, I don't think we begin to understand Donald Trump yet. He gets compared to a lot of people, but he's bigger than almost all of them. For example, I mean, people said, Mark Singer, The New Yorker, said he wants ultimately to be Madonna. He's bigger than Madonna. He's almost Babe Ruthian. I can't remember anybody in my lifetime who has taken all the air out of the room, not just in politics, but in journalism, in humor, in daily conversation, in cartoons, you name it. He's everywhere for almost a year and a half now.
It's astonishing, really. It's astonishing.
You know, Babe Ruth didn't quite do that. I don't know that JFK did
that. I mean, there was a moment. There's a moment where I saw this. I went to they had the 100th anniversary of the Pulitzer Prize where all the winners came to Washington for this ceremony. And I walked to the Washington Post newsroom. There was a panel of like nine televisions on all different channels. Mm-hmm. In the newsroom, everyone had Trump on it. Everyone in the heart of great journalism, the Washington Post. He has done an extraordinary thing. I call it a kind of Scheherazade feat, managing to continue to tell the story over and over in different ways to not get his head chopped off like Scheherazade. Mm. And he has managed that and continues to manage it now at a crescendo in these final few months. And he is very, very hard to counter. All the columns written, he's an idiot, he's lying, he's terrible, and an affront to every value you cherish. They seem to bounce right off him. Because he's playing in a different field than almost all the critics and the other candidates.
Of course, the negatives are there still, too. But how does Hillary Clinton respond to this mystery?
You know, Hillary Clinton has to do something that's very, very hard for her. She needs to manage to be authentic on cue and seem fresh, even though you've spent decades with her. You know, the difficulty is that right now she represents the establishment that has largely failed in the eyes of many Americans. I mean, look, if you step back from this time, left or right, most people are saying we need structural and fundamental change in the United States, and Hillary Clinton does not represent change. Trump, to many people, certainly maybe not you or me or some of our friends, but to many people, he does represent change. It could be disastrous change, change that ruins America for years to come. But he is change and she's not. And when I was at a fundraiser and I had people raise your hands if you know any Hillary Clinton policy, there wasn't one hand that went up. I said, how about Donald Trump? And they did the wall and they did this and they did that. That's a fundamental issue where she's protecting the status quo and he is there to overthrow it at a time when most people feel the status quo is inadequate to America's needs. That's trouble for her.
When the media status quo itself feels terribly threatened,
they do,
by the change of the digitization. They've wrapped themselves around Hillary. I think they've made her life harder. They've ended their life if he wins. They've missed the biggest story that's come out of New York ever.
Well, they missed the weapons of mass destruction, too. They often miss the big story. And right now, I think they're in danger of missing the biggest story of this period. No doubt about it. Part of the problem is the media has become more and more professionalized. We're all a pretty professional bunch now. Lots of us went to good colleges, and we have health plans and all of the rest. And the fact is that they're not really living in the shoes of the folks from Texarkana, you know, where half the
or
town—
Or Queens, a lot of
or
them.
Or Queens either, where lots of real problems have worsened and deepened over decades. And people are saying, hey, I don't see any end to it. And what you're telling me on the glorious coastlines and the updraft of the global economy is that I'm going to race against some workers from countries who will be happy at $3 a day? And that's my lot in life? That's not a better life for my kids. I don't see any way out of that. And a public sector increasingly hollowed out of funding— this isn't working for me. So I need to flip the existing order. And what I want, this is the Trump supporter, I want somebody who will bloody all of you, who will punch you all on the nose on my behalf. I don't even know what he wants to do. All I want is him to do that. That's their man.
What are you telling young lawyers, Ron Suskind, about narrative in this country today?
Well, I'm saying that you need to understand how these large ecosystems called narratives get constructed, because we often live within them and they shape us as to our assumptions, as to our actions, and we often don't recognize that we are living within a crafted narrative. I say, look, understand the mechanisms under these narratives. So you're not simply on the receiving end of them. You may someday help shape them, because they are defining of who we are as a people and the stories we tell ourselves. And that's part of what the class is about. So that they become more aware as citizens and certainly as officers of the court, as those who carry forward law, to understand how often justice gets shaped and its definition gets shaped by these large narratives on race and class, equality, inequality, rather than simply living within the fish tank of this narrative or that. That's what the class is about. How do narratives get shaped? Trump is playing a very powerful, enveloping narrative that has swept up much of the country. And still, many people don't understand how he did it and how he built it.
Do you? I mean, can you diagram it?
Sure. You know, I would diagram the narrative this way. He comes from the glorious coastlines. He has golden towers on both coasts and the golf courses that all of the rich people play at. And he says, I'm not of them. I will come from that peak into the valley, into the wide middle of disenfranchised people in America. And I'll say, I'm really your person. I'm of them, but I'm not really. I'm of you. I am your voice.
Ted Turner managed that somehow.
He did.
Usually rich, monster, powerful guy who blue-collar workers thought was one of them.
It's a feat, and it takes some time, and it takes a kind of odd, maybe even crafted humility, where you're able to say, I'm wrong. Sometimes you say stupid stuff. Sometimes you say, look, I'm just trying to make this up as I go along. You do all those things. Like George W. Bush did some of that, too. Trump is very, very good at it. And by virtue of that, he has created a narrative that they feel comfortable in. People who feel disenfranchised and left behind in the United States. They say, I want my avatar, my ombudsman, to be this guy, specifically because he drives them crazy on the glorious coastlines of people that I despise. Now, there was a moment during the Bush time. I just want to throw this quote out because it was so telling. At one point, I was talking to Mark McKinnon, who was Bush's advisor. And McKinnon was saying to me, you think Bush is an idiot. I said, I don't think he's an idiot. I think he's incurious. I think he's a bit of a bully. No, you think he's an idiot, and they do on the coastlines and in the East Coast and the West Coast and blocks in southern Manhattan near Wall Street. Let me tell you, we don't care. Because you see, you guys are outnumbered 2-3 to 1 by the big beating heart of the middle. And you know what they like about him? They like the way he walks and the way he points. And they're not reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal ever. Not every day. You see, and keep attacking him for the malaprops and the things he says, because you know what they don't like? They don't like you. So when you attack him, it's good for us. Our numbers go up. So just keep it up. Trump gets that. He understands that every time he gets attacked, he seems more and more of them and not of us, and his numbers rise.
Why do the pollsters miss it? Even the smartest of them.
One of the reasons the pollsters are having trouble is because all polls are based on likely voters. Right now, about 40% of eligible adults do not vote in the United States. Even during the Obama election, which is a big one, I think it was 62%. Usually it's right in the high 50s, 58, 59. That's 40% of folks who could vote but are not. They're hard to poll. We got no record for them. You don't even know what party they belong to. Those are Trump's people. Here's the threat. In terms of what the poll numbers are saying and are not saying. If a significant slice of those people get into the game, let's say half of them go for Trump, those are big numbers in a country that still is pretty neatly divided between Democrats and Republicans. If that crowd turns out, Trump could well be the president. And here is one of my fears. You want to know one? Here it is. Trump wins the popular vote, but by virtue of the way the big eastern and western states have an advantage on electoral votes, electoral college votes, she wins the electoral college, he wins the popular vote. You want crazy? That's crazy.
Has he himself planned the turn, the reveal, as they say, the closing act in this campaign?
See, now, Chris, you're thinking like a showbiz guy. What's the reveal? What's the reveal? Yeah, I'm sure he does. I mean, he thinks about it all the time. And my sense is that probably when you get into October, maybe late October, he's going to have a moment of crafted intimacy, which is going to be his reveal, where he's going to say, look, I said things I regret. It's a show, folks.
Didn't mean to hurt anybody.
Hey, come on. Here's what I really
believe. They
love me. Here's what I really believe. I'm really your guy. Let me tell you why. And he'll go low in that low register. And he's good. He's got a very strong cadence, like an actor. He's practiced. And he'll do that, and he'll seem evolving at that moment in a way that will kill off some doubts and engender some sense of possibility. People want change. That's what Hillary has to worry about. She needs to beat him to that punch if she's going to win that popular vote.
This is real, you're saying, in short.
You bet.
This is a race.
This is the real McCoy.
And he could win it, you believe.
No doubt. No doubt.
Ron Suskind has written critically about Democratic presidents, including the incumbent Barack Obama, notoriously about George W. Bush and his reality-based community. We're talking about 2016 and angles that we have not heard, don't read in the New York Times. Coming up, The New Yorker's television critic Emily Nussbaum on art and life, TV shows that feed off politics and feed it too. This is Open Source. Emily Nussbaum of The New Yorker remarked to us this week that there's been an explosion of entertainment shows about politics on television, especially since West Wing appeared 2 decades ago. There's been satire, there's been melodrama, feminism, high comedy, sex, and all sorts of other things. But this bizarre season of Trump in 2016 would have been rejected for television as too unrealistic, she said. A stretch.
It's been a really fascinating boom time for television shows that explore politics. And a while ago, it seemed like there was pretty much nothing on TV about politics. I mean, previous to The West Wing, all of the shows that I could think of were minor things like Spin City or Benson that had political characters but weren't about politicians governing, running for office, about the workings of Washington and things like that. And then not just because of The West Wing and 24, which created a situation in which that was a very hot commercial part of television, but because there's been this enormous expansion in the language of TV drama, there's been this boom of shows where politics are central to them. And a lot of the shows that are on TV that have explored politics, especially shows like Scandal, House of Cards, Game of Thrones, are all about, even Mr. Robot to a certain extent, are all about an enormous, powerful paranoia and a sense of evil in government coming from people at the top moving levers that are causing everything down below to turn in very complicated ways. They're sort of Rube Goldberg devices made up of insidious long cons. That's pretty much the portrait of politics on a lot of these shows.
What I'm about to tell you is top secret. A conspiracy bigger than all of us. There's a powerful group of people out there that are secretly running the world.
I actually wanted to talk about this one show that nobody's been talking about.
Please.
That frustrates me endlessly. Is there's a show on television called Brain Dead right now. Brain Dead actually has a very different theme than a lot of these other shows. Brain Dead, the plot of Brain Dead, which is going to sound completely ridiculous, and it's a very funny show, is about the idea that in Washington right now, because it's taking place during the current election, sort of meteor has landed on the planet and released a bunch of bugs, which have invaded people's ears in Washington and are causing them to essentially become zombified in certain ways. But the show is a massive metaphor because the way they become zombified is not that they become bad guys, it's that they become increasingly partisan.
Our country has been overrun, not with soldiers, not with tanks, but with an infection.
So the people on the right become psychotically right-wing, and the people on the left become intensely left-wing, and the government stops working. And this is one of the rare shows that actually celebrates the style of Washington that most shows put down, which is essentially deal trading, people hanging out with people that they disagree with and sort of finding things in the middle, moderation, and the kind of social lubrication that goes on in Washington. So I actually find this very refreshing. There's this one show on television that doesn't treat the conspiracy plot as the only way to talk about politics. But of course, that's not true on comedies, because there are brilliant political comedies out there too, like Veep and the much-missed Parks and Recreation.
I believe that I've earned your vote. Bobby Newport believes he can buy it. And maybe that's because he's never earned anything his entire life.
That hurt my feelings. You're supposed to be this positive person. Can't we just talk about things we like?
Well said. Just a reminder to our candidates to keep it civil. Looking at you, Leslie.
So it's kind of a boom time for this subject matter.
Emily Nussbaum, you've coined this phrase, aesthetic Esperanto, to describe a sort of neutral third language in which people at the water cooler just going to strip politics down or deal with it. What is it saying? And what does it tell you that this language has somehow run ahead of the so-called game?
By aesthetic Esperanto, I think you're referring to my Game of Thrones review, right?
Yeah.
Where I was talking about the fact that that show in particular, partially I think because it's such a strange, extreme, larger-than-life fantasy show, but it's a safe way for people to talk about their own political values. When you actually try to talk about the Democrats and the Republicans and Trump and Clinton and Bernie Sanders and all of these kinds of subjects, inevitably conversations blow up and people become enraged. If you're talking about Game of Thrones, you can use it essentially as a language everybody speaks that you can discuss those same things and not end all your friendships. But that's an exaggeration. I mean, I do think that there's some truth to the fact that show, especially this season, has functioned as this very strange scrim for a kind of a dark view of politics, in which the question becomes, what sort of person achieves power? What's the best way of achieving power? And in a really sick system, because that show is about just a hyper-patriarchy in which all power is distributed through families that trade it through marriage and who kill and torture anybody in their way. Is there any way to break that? Is there any way to break the extremely violent elitism of that system? And so that becomes the sort of subject of the show.
Prominent families often forget a simple truth.
And which truth is that?
Knowledge is power.
Seize him. Cut his throat. Stop. Wait. I've changed my mind. Let him go. Power is power.
I think TV has been complicated when it's come to Hillary Clinton. There have been a lot of images of a Hillary Clinton-like person on TV, but she's often been demonized, as she is on House of Cards, where it's kind of a Lady Macbeth version.
I'm done trying to win over people's hearts.
One thing that fascinates me about a show like Game of Thrones or House of Cards, both of which I think are, I mean, especially Game of Thrones, I think is a really interesting show. But what Game of Thrones most reminds me of is not necessarily another drama TV show, but actually Survivor, because those are both shows where the question of the show is what kind of personality wins. They're essentially shows about human psychological strategies as applied to politics. And so they become about this question of, does the good person become a good leader? Does the person who uses violence become the better, more effective leader? Is it better to be a Lannister than a Stark? Is it better? And on Survivor, you know, how do you form alliances? How do you betray people? All of those kinds of conversations are central both to a lot of reality TV shows where people are constantly trying to win and saying, I'm not here to make friends, and to a lot of these dramas. I think that also becomes a big conversation in real life politics where people say, well, what kind of person is presidential and what does it take to win the race? In that sense, it does become a drama.
Listeners, go to our website, please, for uncut long forms of our conversations with Emily Nussbaum and Frank Rich. They're really terrific at radioopensource.org. Ron Suskind is our guest in the studio. Emily Nussbaum was just speaking there of survival method of learning how to do politics, how to make allies, when to betray them. Could it be better than running for school committee or your state legislature or going to the Kennedy School for that matter?
Well, you know, what Emily is talking about is something that's really quite important, is that we draw a lot from these narrative tropes that we watch on television. I don't think often we realize how shaping they are of our expectations, our notion of how stories work, and how we build expectations as to what people will do and why. And I think what you're finding now is that we have jumped that fourth wall, kicked it down, and we're watching that drama occur in the life of the country. And people actually don't even flinch. They're like, of course. I mean, knowledge is power. I love that. Power is power. Story is power in this period. Who tells the best story? Don't worry about the facts. Tell the story. Tell it over and over again in different ways, different voices, different hues. That's what they're doing. They're telling their stories. Trump is very good at it. Hillary, not so good. She may get better under stress. She's very good when she's down. That's when we like her the best. And if she ends up being behind in the polls, I think you'll see more of the Hillary that people may want.
That's a very different model of how to rise in political life. I it immediately reminds me of Sam Rayburn, the great House Speaker from Texas, saying he would have thought better of a lot of those JFK whiz kids if just one of them had run for sheriff.
Yeah, right.
Once.
Yeah, right.
Tried local politics.
Yeah, right, right. Press the flesh. Got down.
Should they
there.
Have done a Survivor show?
You're right. Look, Survivor, you bet. You bet. Survivor works.
Frank Rich threw out the notion that as radical and new as this Trump phenomenon seems to be, it's also the end of an era, a television era that began, let us say, with JFK and maybe wearing out. Not only wearing out, the medium is wearing out.
Yeah. Well, Frank's doing medium, his message there, and I think he's right about that particular medium of television. But the fact it's really being replaced by another powerful visual carrier of images, whether it's through your devices or your PDAs or your computer. I mean, I don't buy the idea that we are ending a period. I think we're transmogrifying into a new one that in some ways has more dark potency to it. Because, you know, you're not there doing the shared thing anymore. Mm-hmm. You're doing it to yourself, by yourself, from a community that you've already signed on to. That's very, very different. And it's a very divided country, bifurcated into little tribal chunks. And that's problematic. That's why these debates are so important. They're one of the few areas in which everyone will gather in a country that's deeply divided. Everyone will watch it. And that's why the debates even carry more force now in some ways than they did with Nixon and Kennedy. Because it's the only thing everyone will watch together. And the ratings on these debates will break all of the records.
I'm sure. Do you want to coach these candidates? Except hold that thought. There's another Frank Rich point that I wanted you to...
Yeah.
And now am I blocking it? The point that a lot of people are saying now, that the Trump era is going to persist whether or not he wins,
you
whether
bet.
Or not he starts a new news network. But this mobilization of the angry, the economically dispossessed,
yeah,
is going to be with us forever. Not you shouldn't say forever.
Well, it's with us
for the foreseeable future.
It's with us until it's corrected. Let's be frank about it.
Oh, thank you. That's a good point.
That's it. Until someone corrects it. Someone says, look, it's not about making the peaks higher. It's about the valley rising. We got to figure out a way to do that. Otherwise, we're going to have deep division of rich and poor, of enormous inequality. And the fact is, it's easy to say, hey, we'll work that out someday when you're on the peak. When you're in the valley, you take it personally. And the fact is, until someone settles that problem, we will be a country divided against itself. As Lincoln says, it cannot survive. Trump is singing that song.
Well, he sings it on alternate Tuesdays.
Oh. I mean, yep.
Can you imagine him, you know, moving to that almost Bernie-esque position in a debate?
Well, he jumps around in every direction. I mean, the man is diabolically ingenious here. I mean, just pick out one or two positions and you see how off the grid he is. Just take one, tariffs. He's saying to countries, look, you're messing with us, you're screwing us, we're 30% trade deficit, whatever it is. I'm going to slap a 30% tariff on you. Who does tariffs? Democrats do tariffs to protect workers. Here, Trump's doing it as a Republican.
I'll give you another one. He said, sorry, Hillary's generals have no idea how to fight ISIS. Who says that about our generals? Except a few, you know, people like Andy Bacevich say.
Yep. And Andy says it.
But who else in our politics says, Jeb, your brother was lying.
Right. Yeah.
He knew better.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And Jeb is trying to defend W? I mean, look, the fact is Jeb didn't even have a response to that, which is unbelievably unconscionable, that he didn't even have a response ready for what he knew would be the first attack and the first charge. Ultimately, he's all over the lot. Sometimes he's saying things that are nonsensical. Sometimes he's saying things that are crazy like a fox and actually right on point. And that's why, again, you can't take your eyes off him. And you want to see what he'll do next. And there'll be plenty of people who will want to see what he'll do next as president that will surprise you. I mean, look, the fact is Tom Edsel, very smart political reporter,
yes,
talked about the Tom Bradley effect. What people say
you
to pollsters
poll on a black candidate
versus what they do in the polling booth.
Right.
There's often a gap there. And, you know, and I think that right now what we're dealing with is a couple of months where the establishment of the United States that really, you know, sort of runs the levers of power may wake up to say, you know, this is serious. This is about fault line issues in America. It's not just about one guy. It's reality based in that way. Trump sees the reality and he's playing it like a fiddle.
So play the coach game before the debate, especially around Mrs. Clinton.
Okay. You want to do Trump? I'll do Clinton.
Well.
Okay, come on.
I'll play any game with you, but
okay.
How do you come on as
okay, I'll do Hillary. I'll do Hillary. Here's what we should do. Hillary, say, look, you know, I'm not very good at this. I'm not a reality
Hillary,
show star.
Don't give us
but
that
the fact
routine.
Is
you've
that,
been in this thing for 35
this fact
years.
Is say, you know, you want a story? I'll tell you a story. I'll tell you a story of a woman whose husband did things that broke her heart. That's me. That's me in reality. You want reality? I'll give you reality. I will fight you to the death if you are taking down people who are poor and powerless. I'll fight you to the end of time. I'll take on people who needlessly enrich themselves.
Hillary,
to the
cut
disaster
it out. You're
of
the
others.
Best friend Wall Street ever had. There was no Wall Street in the White House until your guy Bill brought him in.
You know, the fact of the matter is that I played the game, everyone played the game, and you played the game worse than everyone else. I'd never enrich myself like
but
you
I'm
did.
I'm a gamester. Everybody knows that.
You know, the fact is that what I'm doing here is I'm taking the country to a future that you can't even imagine because your imagination is zero. You've got no imagination. You're
my
utterly
imagination?
You're utterly derivative.
I invited you to my wedding, and you had to come. That took certain fortitude and imagination, too.
Right, and I had the imagination.
Who would have thought you'd have come?
Right, right. I had the imagination to say, I'm going to ask Donald Trump for money.
You ask everybody for money, Hillary, and they give it to you.
You know, that's the country I'm trying to end, Donald. The country where a guy like you rises to the peak. The fact of the matter is we have people who need real opportunity in this country and not a lot of rich guys enriching themselves based on perfidy.
Did any other former president and his wife make $150 million afterward? Let's get real.
Well, look, if they could, they would.
Oh, come on. That's what they offered me, $625,000 for three lousy talks that I'm not going to tell you about.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, the fact is that you make a lot more than that, crushing people and crushing lives and crushing cities all over America. I kind of made it clean. The fact is, this is the way Winston Churchill paid bills, too.
He was a better pro-stylist than you, my dear girl.
With speaking fees.
And books that are still selling that are classic. What did he say? History is going to be kind to me because I'm going to write it.
Well, the winners write history mostly. Right now, though, history is being written right before our eyes. That's why it's going to be an extraordinary 3 months in the United States. And make no mistake, it'll be surge and counter-surge with giant teams pushing against each other all through the fall up until the day of informed consent.
And I'm not going to ruin the fun for you, Hillary or Ron, by asking you how it comes out. Let's leave it there for the moment, but we'll come back to it. Ron Suskind, this is fun. Thanks also to Emily Nussbaum and Frank Rich. Our show is produced this week by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. George Hicks is our engineer. I'm Christopher Leiden. Join us next time on Open Source.